Hello, welcome to Chalk Radio, where medical experts from Children's Hospital of Orange County shared their knowledge about keeping kids healthy and safe. Today, Dr. Neil Nakra, a Chalk pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist, and Dr. Marnie Nagel, a Chalk psychologist, are here to discuss sleep disorders in children. Dr. Nakra, Dr. Nagel, welcome to Seacrest Studios.
Thank you.
So, to get us started, Dr. Nakra, tell us a little bit about sleep disorders. What are sleep disorders?
So sleep disorders can encompass a wide variety of things. Essentially, it's any issue that makes sleep difficult to initiate, difficult to maintain, and can lead to a lot of manifestations during the day.
So what are some of the signs that a child has a sleep disorder?
Again, it depends on the type of sleep disorder you're talking about. The one that we most commonly deal with is obstructive sleep apnea, which can occur at any age. The main things that I ask patients and their families about when I see them in the office is, do they have any issues with nighttime snoring, any issues with mouth breathing, and does the family ever notice any pauses in the breathing when they're sleeping at night? And if they say yes to any of those questions, then I kind of delve a little bit further in terms of what time do they go to bed, how often are they waking up at night, what time do they wake up in the morning, and then, like I was saying, in regards to the daytime manifestations, a lot of times this can lead to issues, especially for our school-age kids, with trouble in school. So things along the lines of problems with concentration in school, hyperactivity, behavior issues in school. So we go down that road when we're in the office and asking those questions, and then based on what their answers are, go through it a little bit in more detail.
Okay. One thing that I'm curious about with what you said about lack of concentration in school or hyperactivity or anything like that, how often do you guys see like a misdiagnosis for medication for ADHD or things like that versus your
right.
sleep disorders?
It's not, I wouldn't necessarily say a misdiagnosis, but I think one of the things, especially over the last 5 to 10 years with a lot of the research that's been done in the sleep field, is how the two can kind of make each other worse. So in the sense of if a child is, I would say a good percentage of the kids that I see in the office are already on some sort of ADHD medication. And so one of the things I think that is important, and one of the things I try to stress when I go out and meet with pediatricians, general pediatricians, is when you're going down that road, when you're having these kids in your office who have symptoms of ADHD, when you're going down the road of starting to prescribe them medications for that, is to investigate the possibility of obstructive sleep apnea. And there's certainly a big overlap between the two. And I think that when we diagnose obstructive sleep apnea, and certainly when we treat obstructive sleep apnea, it's not to say that you can necessarily take those kids off their ADHD medications, but it's an additive thing, the sleep apnea and the ADHD. So if you can resolve the sleep apnea, oftentimes it can make those symptoms better.
Interesting.
Okay. I can add.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
So I often get referrals in my office to rule out an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and always sleep is at the forefront of my mind. And so certainly children who are not getting good quality sleep at home can have a lot of symptoms that mimic ADHD. And we know, just think about ourselves as adults, when we're sleep deprived, it's much more difficult to focus, we make more errors in our daily tasks that we do, we can be irritable or grumpy and have a difficult time following directions and staying on task. And so certainly a child with those symptoms absolutely could have ADHD, but it also is very important to look at the nature and quality of their sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and the only reason I ask that, I have a number of friends that have children with ADHD, and in none of those cases have I ever heard them say, oh yeah, we went and did something with sleep as well to kind of rule that part of things out. Mm-hmm. And I found that very interesting when you said that, mm-hmm. you know, there could be those issues that kind of mimic some other things that,
yeah.
you know, possibly this could help.
And I think even aside from the diagnosis of ADHD, but kind of getting to the point that Dr. Nagel was talking about in terms of concentration and ability to complete tasks and things along those lines, I mean, you see it across the spectrum. I mean, even if you look at in the adult population, I mean, there's now duty hour restrictions for medical residents because of the medical errors that are associated with people who've been awake for more than 24 hours. There's restrictions on the number of hours a pilot can fly a plane in a row. There's restrictions in terms of truck drivers and how long they could be on the road. I mean, so over the last 10 to 20 years, there's been quite a bit of research that's been gone on into this field that manifests both in the pediatric and the adult population.
That's excellent. So with that, how much sleep do you think a child needs?
So there are some general guidelines for the recommended hours of sleep for children, and these are general ranges, and so certainly each individual child will have their own optimal sleep patterns, but in general, the younger the child, the more sleep they require. So 0 to 3 month olds generally need 14 to 17 hours. That includes nighttime as well as any naps during the day. 4 to 11 month olds need 12 to 15 hours. 1 to 2 year olds, our toddlers, need 11 to 14 hours of sleep. 3 to 5 year olds need 10 to 13 hours. In general, during that age range is when the daytime nap tends to fade away. And so for the remaining age groups, you're really looking at nighttime sleep and trying as much as possible to limit daytime napping. Our school-age children, the 6 to 13-year-olds, need 9 to 11 hours of sleep. The teenagers, our 14 to 17-year-olds, need 8 to 10 hours of sleep. It's very rare for me to meet with a teenager who actually gets that amount of sleep, but that is their optimal number of hours per sleep that they should get. And then our young adults, our 18 to 25-year-olds, need 7 to 9 hours.
Okay, great. You know, with that, you know, you as a parent, you go along and, you know, maybe some of these things are working out to where that timing is going, or maybe it's not. And when should a parent come see a sleep specialist? When should that happen?
Again, I think it's going to depend on the symptoms that the family is noticing at home. Certainly, if they're having symptoms of sleep apnea, that's the major reason that we'll see a lot of patients in clinic. But it can be even to the point for, like Dr. Nagel was referring to, in terms of our younger patients, and it can also often be times difficult to initiate sleep. So it's called childhood behavioral insomnia. And so, you know, it's those two-year-olds who, you know, they come into your room, mommy, there's a monster under my bed. Mommy, I want a drink of water. Mommy, can you read the story again? And all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it can be as simple as just kind of behavioral modifications, getting the child to sleep through the night. And then to more of the kind of organic medical pathology, like I was saying, in terms of sleep apnea, and, you know, when you get into the teenage group, you know, insomnia and things along those lines.
So why would it be important for a child to see a sleep specialist?
I think, again, one of the things that we're emphasizing is just how abnormalities in sleep and the quality of sleep and the quantity of sleep that you get can manifest across the board. And so, to, you know, along the lines of anything from ADHD to an inability to function on a level that they're supposed to based on age or, you know, intelligence or things like that. I mean, you need optimal sleep in order to perform optimally during the day.
Yeah, I was always told it's kind of like that whole, the car metaphor is what I got. You got to take care of your car in order for it to run, and your body and mind are kind of the same way, I would imagine. And, you know, I know for myself, when I get a good night's sleep, like, I'm on it all day. I don't have to get coffee. I don't have to do any of the caffeine stuff. But I can only imagine for children, it must be a little bit more difficult for them to kind of compensate when they get a lack of sleep as well.
And I think it's not only school-age children, but especially our adolescents and our teenagers. And there's been, over the last, I'd say about 2 years ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with recommendations in terms of what time school should start. Mm-hmm. And that was a big issue in the kind of lay press, because for various reasons, a lot of school districts will start, the high school is the first school of the day. It's the first one that opens during the day. And what that essentially was doing is, as you get older, especially for our adolescent patients, they have what's called delayed sleep phase. Their natural kind of hormonal cycles, melatonin, all of that delays their sleep to closer from anywhere from 11 to, some people could even be like 1 o'clock in the morning, when they're naturally going to be more likely to fall asleep. And then, like Dr. Nagel was saying, in terms of the number of hours that they're supposed to get, I mean, you try to fit in a 8-hour sleep at night starting at midnight, they're already in second period by that time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? It doesn't work out.
And it's interesting because there's been a good amount of research that's been done on this, and they've shown that if you delay school openings for high school students, it can lead to less motor vehicle accidents mm-hmm. in the morning. It can lead to improved scoring on standardized tests. And a lot of school districts now are looking at that because it's the cheapest way that you could theoretically improve the scoring that a lot of the school districts now, with Common Core and things like that, that their budgets are tied to, you know. And so there has been, over the last 2 years, a big movement towards pushing school back.
That's absolutely.
And that's just delaying it by 1 hour.
Yeah.
We're not even talking about large amounts of time.
Wow.
By 1 hour. Just to go back to a couple of other things of why sleep is so important. During sleep, during restorative sleep, is also when all of us really consolidate our learning from that day. And it also allows for memory and retention. And so for children, especially who are learning at such rapid paces, 90% of brain development occurs by the age of 3 years, another 5% by 5 years of age. The amount of learning that takes place is massive, and sleep is critical in order to make those connections, to consolidate those learning patterns, and to be able to use that information in the future. So it really affects all functions, all stages of development. It affects your emotional regulation. It affects your focusing and attention. It affects your memory. It affects your learning. It's incredibly pervasive.
Wow.
Over time, I've gone and spoken to districts of school nurses and various groups of high school students, especially, and college-age students. And one of the things I stress to them, especially kind of where we are in Orange County and how much of a drive there is with education and, you know, achievement in school, the amount of learning that you get if you pull an all-nighter trying to cram for your test the next day pales in comparison to the amount of learning that will be consolidated if you actually got the 8 hours of sleep that night and didn't try to learn everything the few hours before your exam.
Yeah, I feel like I've always done better when I study over a long period of time versus...
It's better to not figure that out by trial and error than to actually, you know...
Exactly. There are also physical health indicators that are associated with better quality of sleep. And so even things like growth hormone is secreted while sleeping, and obesity rates are linked with poor sleep as well. And even your susceptibility to common colds and viruses, your immune system also is stronger when you get adequate sleep.
Excellent. So say I'm a parent and I have my kid and we come and see a sleep specialist. How is that sleep disorder then diagnosed once we're with you guys?
So the gold standard way to diagnose, let's again start with what's the most common reason that we see patients obstructive sleep apnea is by an overnight sleep study. And that's an in-house, in-lab study for our pediatric population. So, you know, whether we have a sleep lab here in Chocolate Orange, we also have a sleep lab at Chocolate Mission. And we're running studies 7 nights a week. And so the patient comes in, and depending on, unless they're over 18, if they're under 18, they'll come and with a parent or guardian, and they'll spend the night. They got a lot of lead placements for monitoring of breathing, EEG brain activity, muscle activity, and we watch them sleep. We observe their respiration, see if they are snoring, if they are having pauses in the breathing, what happens with their oxygen levels when all that occurs, and cumulatively over the course of the night, determine if they're having any sleep-disordered breathing. And from there, if they are, like Dr. Nagel was saying, there's the two main reasons for that in our patient population is going to be because of big tonsils or adenoids. So those are lymphoid tissue in the airway or in the back of the nose. And what they do is intrinsically in the airway block the airway. And so all of us, when we're sleeping, when we go into REM sleep, we lose muscle tone. There's a decrease in muscle tone. If there's no other medical issue, that's not necessarily, it doesn't lead to any problem. But if you have relatively large tonsils or adenoids that are already decreasing the diameter of that airway by say 50-60%, and then you lose muscle tone, then that can lead to collapse of the airway, obstruction of airflow. So that hence leads to obstructive sleep apnea. So probably I would say 15 to 20 years ago, that was the number one reason why kids that we in the pediatric population would have sleep apnea. It still is, but a very, very close second these days is obesity. So instead of having that kind of intrinsic obstruction inside the area with the adenoids and the tonsils, when you have obesity, you have an extrinsic. So if you essentially have 5 to 6 pounds of fat on top of your neck because of your obesity, when you get into that REM sleep again, that's causing the airway to narrow and to collapse and lead to the pauses in the breathing. So oftentimes that'll be, especially for our older kids, the reason that they have sleep apnea. And then the treatment for that, which Dr. Nagel helps us achieve, is CPAP or BiPAP, which is a mask that you put over the nose or the nose and the mouth, and it blows air in. So essentially kind of stenting open that airway to keep it open regardless of what stage of sleep you're in.
Okay, and that's what I want to talk about next is what do we do once this has been diagnosed? What are some of the treatments for sleep disorders?
Mm-hmm. So as Dr. Nacker was saying, for sleep apnea, the treatment is PAP treatment, whether it's CPAP or BiPAP. And some children and teenagers tolerate it very well, and they love their PAP equipment, and they recognize how much more rested and refreshed they are when they use it at night. Other individuals, unfortunately, have a very difficult time tolerating the PAP equipment. And so that's where I join our sleep apnea team. And I help children and teenagers and young adults learn how to tolerate their PAP equipment so that they can benefit from the treatment. For some individuals, they have hypersensitivity, and so the equipment feels very uncomfortable to them. Sometimes it's the mask itself that feels uncomfortable, and sometimes it's the pressure of the air. And so it's using what we call behavioral desensitization. It's a behavioral approach that moves in very, very small increments or baby steps towards a targeted goal. And our targeted goal is getting them to use the equipment as prescribed. Right. For some individuals, it's really starting at zero. So even just looking at the equipment, moving closer to touching the equipment.
Being in the same room with it.
Being in the same room with the equipment. And while they're experiencing that feeling of discomfort or anxiety, is being able to decrease those feelings while in the presence of the equipment until they're no longer feeling that discomfort and they feel back to baseline. When they're successful at doing that at that stage, then we move to the next goal. And so we slowly shape the behavior towards the desired behavior, which is being able to wear the equipment as prescribed for the length of time prescribed, which is any time they're asleep.
Wonderful.
So that's for the sleep apnea. Oftentimes we'll have children that have insomnia. And as Dr. Nacker said, behavioral insomnia in childhood is usually related to difficulties falling asleep or difficulty staying asleep or very early awakenings in the morning. And so sometimes there are very good medical reasons for that. So, for example, often our children with epilepsy that are on anti-epileptic medications, a lot of the side effects of those medications include insomnia. But sometimes there is no known medical diagnosis associated with the insomnia, and it is more of a behavioral insomnia. And so the treatment for that is working with families on providing optimal sleep environments. So that often includes good sleep hygiene. And that 90% of the time can really take care of the issue. So it's providing the education to patients and families about what good sleep hygiene looks like and providing the environment that will allow for that. Sometimes it's identifying barriers to actually being able to have a good sleep environment and problem solving around those barriers, eliciting extra support with that. So that can be it. And then really just creating a new habit. And so anytime you're changing behavior, it's hard. We are creatures of habit, and we like to do what we always do. And whenever we're under stress, we go back to what is most comfortable. And so it's really creating these new healthy lifestyles, these new habits, which can take time and often need a little bit of assistance.
And I think kind of speaking to the sleep hygiene, it's not necessarily something that we see in the office a lot. I think general pediatricians are good about kind of investigating this and dealing with it. But it's something that we often stress just in general with some of our more complex sleep patients, especially when it comes to our adolescent teenager patients. I feel like the vast, vast majority of them are unable to breathe if they don't have their cell phone, like within arm's distance of them. We often stress to the families, to the patients, that the amount of blue light that's emitted off of a screen, whether it be a laptop or an iPad or a cell phone, is very, very similar to the amount that's emitted from the sun. And so the way we've evolved over millions of years is to be awake when it's light outside and to be sleepy when it's dark outside. And if you're just looking at a screen, that's essentially like looking, like being outside at noon, and then you switch it off, put it under your pillow, which they often do, and then try to fall asleep. It's very difficult to do that. We see patients all the time, and I could think of one who I just saw in the last week, high achieving, you know, straight A student, junior in high school, who came because she just was sleepy all the time during the day, and I was having a hard time falling asleep. And she says, well, you know, I think she was like in orchestra or something like that, and then I get home, it's like 6 o'clock, I eat dinner, and then I have about 6 hours of homework. And so we literally went through each of those 6 hours, and she actually had about three.
Wow.
The other 3 hours she was spending like texting and chatting,
right,
and doing everything else. And she spends like the hour before she actually falls asleep in her bed doing all those things. It's just your brain is awake and wired at that point that it becomes very difficult to initiate sleep. And so a lot of, you know, being in a dark room that's, somewhat cold and not having any of those. We used to, I mean, when I started this, and I don't feel like I'm that old, but when I started this, we used to always ask, do you have a TV in the room?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has a TV in the room anymore, but they have a tablet that,
right,
they watch Netflix on and, you know, everything else like that. So it's, the technology has made it much more difficult to kind of fall asleep and stay asleep. And so that's one of the things in terms of relearning with the patients that we see in clinic that we talk about.
Yeah. In addition to the light that it emits, again, oftentimes teenagers sleep with their phone right near their bed, if not actually under their pillow.
Yeah, right.
And they have alerts that let them know when they get a text message or something like that. And so they're never really going into a deeper sleep because,
right,
they're constantly being aroused out of sleep by these alerts that let them know that there's some earth-shattering
life-altering message
to right now.
Oh.
So, I mean, optimally, we do recommend keeping the phone outside of the bedroom. That's very difficult to enforce, but
I'm sure, especially a lot of them use them for alarms and everything else in their life. And like, I can imagine that a phone would be, that would be a very difficult thing, even at my age, to like leave out,
yeah,
of the room.
Yeah. It's funny though, because we still call it, it's not really a phone anymore.
No,
right?
It's,
I mean,
not.
Nobody, hardly anybody uses it.
To talk.
The percentage of the percentage that you actually use your cell phone as a phone is minuscule.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's all that other thing that phone does that keeps our patients awake at night.
That's
what we're really trying to, it's a hard,
that's a very difficult thing.
Like Dr. Nagel saying, to try to change that type of behavior is a very difficult thing, even,
yeah,
at this age where it just set in the last couple of years, but you know.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you guys both for coming in. It's been amazing talking to you about this. So thank you for listening to Chalk Radio. You just heard Dr. Neil Nakra, a chalk pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist, and Dr. Marnie Nagel, a chalk psychologist, discuss sleep disorders in children. Stay tuned for more episodes and health topics from Chalk Radio. Visit chalk.org/blog for more information, or follow Chalk on social media. We are at Chalk Children's on Instagram and Twitter, and we're at facebook.com/chalkchildrens. Guys, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.